Screw it, we're just gonna talk about comics.
Welcome to Screw It, we're just going to talk about comics. I'm talking about comic books specifically. This is the only podcast hosted by two brothers, two older white men discussing things they grew up loving, and that thing they grew up loving is comic books. I'm one of your co-hosts, Kevin Hines.
I'm your other co-host, Will Hines. Here's some salient details about us. We're hilarious. Mm-hmm. We are semi-professional comedians. Super professional improv teachers, and that's it. Those are the only salient details I can think you'll need to know.
Yeah. We're both average-ish height.
Kevin's both straight up. You're straight up tall.
I don't. I think 6 feet is the upper end of average.
Okay.
Gosh. And you're the bottom end of average at 3'6". I got a beard. Does that count? Yeah, I got back hair.
This season we are going over a comic book called The Sandman. We're doing a smattering of Sandman, just sort of a sampling of issues from across its 75-issue run, talking about the horror/fantasy comic series from DC/Vertigo Comics. Inhale.
We are deep into the season at this point, Will.
Yeah, we've got this and then two more episodes left.
Probably, yeah.
Probably.
You've added another one to the list already, but last week we covered issue 54.
Mm-hmm.
We had a guest on, Casey
who's
a fan of Mike Allred, who discussed that with us.
Yeah.
And today we're covering the issue you picked from World's End.
Cerements.
That's issue 55.
Yeah.
Cerements.
So it's kind of, for Casey Bruce from Danger Room Comics in Olympia, Washington, about this issue. It's weird that so he did one from World's End. You know, by all rights, I should have just skipped my issue because we really haven't ever done two issues from one arc. But you know what? Who cares? No one's paying for this. There's no ads. We can break the rules when we see. We're not like Sandman. We're not diligent to our responsibilities. We break rules left and right.
Most people say World's End is the most important volume.
I know. It's also like not crucial to the larger. I mean, it's really good, but it's not like doing two from Doll's House or Kindly Ones or something.
Well, the way this worked is we picked the issues you wanted to cover.
That's right.
And then we asked Casey to be on. And we said, pick another issue. He happened to pick one right before an issue we were covering, which is totally cool.
Totally fine, yeah.
A very different issue from anything we've covered, so it was very...
just like good improvisers, we did not adjust our preconceived choice to match the new
that's
choice.
That's right. So we're still covering this issue.
Yeah, well, I love this issue, so I'm glad we're doing it. It's issue 55, Cerements in the World's End Arc. Yeah, it's probably the most confusing... it's the most confusing one we will go over, I think.
Yeah, this is drawn by Shay Anton Pensa, with inks by Vince Locke. And just like the previous issue, it's got a framing sequence by Brian Talbot and Mark Buckingham.
And we wanted to say right here, next episode, we will be going over issue 69 from the Kindly Ones. So if you're reading along and you want to read ahead, the next episode will be issue 69 from the Kindly Ones. We did not say that in advance, but that's what it's going
to
be.
I think we referred to an issue TBD from the Kindly Ones.
Now it has been deed.
And as the kids say, this thing has been deed real hard. We deed it hard.
No, did you guys hear? The Kindly Ones issue has been deed. no longer TB deed.
So that'll be next week. We'll cover that issue, the Kindly Ones. And then we're going to cover one more from the Wake.
Yep, which that is TBD.
that's TBD.
That's TBD.
Can't wait to D that.
It'll be deed by next week, by next episode.
That's right.
But it's TBD at this moment. Kevin, what did you think of this issue?
It's good. I think you had mentioned that this one had a very stories within stories feel to it.
That's why I
believe you had mentioned, which just makes me think of Arabian Nights, the 1001 Tales of Scheherazade book where she's telling stories to stay alive. Do you know this?
I know the fables version.
Well, the 1001 Arabian Nights, the book, I've read a version of this book. I think there's billions of versions of it. I read the popular one that they sold at Walden Books.
Mm-hmm. Cause you're a man of the people.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Scheherazade is imprisoned by, Sultan or something, and he's going to kill her. He kills every wife he's ever had the night after he marries them or something.
Yeah.
But they're like trying to break this curse. It's something like that. But to keep him from killing her, she tells stories. So every night she tells a story, and then by the time the story's done, he's tired and he goes to sleep. And so like every night she has to come up with a new story. And some of the stories involve people telling stories.
Yeah.
And he kind of can, some of the stories can go in deep. And that's where like Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves and Aladdin and his genie lamp.
Yeah.
All that stuff is in there.
Okay. I know the Fables version, which I think is by Mark Buckingham also.
Drawn by Mark Buckingham, probably. Yeah.
I think written by.
Well, if it's Fables, wouldn't it be written by the guy who wrote Bill Willingham?
Oh, yeah. Bill Willingham. That's who it is.
Who wrote the whole series?
Mark Buckingham probably has nothing to do with it. Never mind.
Mark Buckingham drew, I would say, 2/3 of Fables.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. And Bill Willingham also draws, confusingly.
Yes. Not as good. Mark Buckingham is great. No offense to Bill Willingham. I think he would say the same thing.
No, let's shit all over him. Let's like rip him apart.
But Mark Buckingham is great.
He's known more as a writer than an artist.
Yeah, though I think in one of the issues of Fables, Mark Buckingham did write a story that Bill Willingham drew.
It's rad.
Just for like fun.
Well, they do one where Snow White has been like captured by somebody and she has to tell stories to stay alive. Mm-hmm. And so it's, I guess, you know, homage to 1001
Arabian Nights. Yeah, I mean, they also cross over with some of the characters from Arabian Nights.
Yeah.
Fables is one of those types of books. Fables is a great series. You should read it.
Everyone should read it. Not the actual Fables, but the comic book adaptation of Fables.
It's like Once Upon a Time, the ABC moderately successful show.
But better.
But comic book.
Yeah.
I think better, yeah. But I say that without ever having watched Once Upon a Time.
Me either. I just always like to say the comic book's better. Yeah, so this is a real Stories Within Stories one, and that's kind of why I picked it. I think it's really good also, but I kind of enjoy the confusingness of it, so.
Yeah. So I enjoyed it. The world is very strange that all these stories take place in.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll get into that.
It makes me laugh a little bit. It's sort of silly in some sort of very deadpan way.
It's also interesting, both this and last issue, The Golden Boy, I forget that it's a Sandman book.
Yeah, Sandman, the character, is barely involved.
And like both times when the Endless show up, I'm like, oh, right.
Yeah.
At first I'm like, oh, neat, they brought them in. I'm like, well, of course they brought them in. It's their book.
Yeah.
Like the last issue, like Death shows up first and then Sandman shows up briefly after that. And I was just sort of like, oh yeah, look at that, an Endless.
Yeah.
In this non-Endless story.
Whoops.
Then this one, the same thing. Like it's even subtler in this, more subtle in this one.
Yeah.
I don't know if subtler is a word.
I think it is.
But more subtle sounds right.
I'll register it as a word before this gets released.
Oh, good. Because we'll get emails for sure.
I will. I'm the one who's being yelled at for being too fussy about words. Trust me, I'm nonplussed about it. I think.
I forget what I said wrong. I said one wrong too at some point.
Yeah, you did.
But it didn't have the impact. I let it roll off me. But anyway, these stories are really good, but it almost feels like, oh, why are you bringing the Endless into this? I don't know.
It you almost don't need them.
It throws me, though it is also cool in another way.
I don't know. Neil Gaiman has some real chops as a writer. Like, he doesn't need his main character. He doesn't need fight scenes.
There you
scenes.
Go. Yeah. Will Hines said it.
Was a big overstatement. Yeah, I'll say a lot of crazy things.
Neil Gaiman has writer's chops.
Mm-hmm. The Beatles, their melodies are catchy. I'll say it.
Whoa.
Steven Spielberg has been commercially successful at times.
Yeah. Michelangelo, probably going to...
Influential.
Some people are going to care about his stuff.
Antarctica, cold. So, okay, just to refresh y'all's, let's get into it. So this is the World's End arc, like we said last episode, is the framing story is two humans from our world. We're driving.
Can I interrupt you with a total waste of time?
Yeah, why not?
Every time we get to a point where like, well, let's get started. I always think of that Steve Martin joke. Let's not waste any more time. That's always what jumps in my mind.
Yeah, and then he
tunes his banjo for like 3 minutes.
Looks at his nails, whistles.
Yeah. That's what I think about when you tell me that we should get started. I'm like, oh, I agree. And in my mind, I'm like, so we shouldn't, right?
Something that is very instrumental to our childhood is the Steve Martin stand-up special. I think A Night with Steve. It played on Showtime a million times when we were kids, and Then it kind of like wasn't easily available. And then it was released as part of the Steve Martin like DVD comedy set like 5 years ago or something.
But we had a VHS tape of it as well, but it took us forever to find that.
Yeah. And, but to me, it's like one of the books of the Bible. Like I watched it so much.
Yeah.
And Steve Martin is so huge still. It's strange to me that people haven't seen that, because that to me is the foundation of Steve Martin. It's like I almost think I wouldn't care about him if I didn't know that like stand-up special.
Yeah, he certainly hasn't done anything in ages to make you make him as famous as he is.
Yeah. He's coasting. It's not any day now it's going to collapse around him.
I mean, at a certain point it never goes away, but yeah, it started there or peaked or it started. The climax started there.
Yeah.
And continued through The Jerk and a few other movies.
There's just a lot of Steve Martin fans who are like, oh, I've never seen this thing. And it's like, that's so strange. It's like, oh, I love Jim Carrey. I've never seen The Mask. It's like, well, I'm not even saying The Mask is the end all be all, but that's weird. If you're a Jim Carrey fan and you've never seen one of the big things in his like career or whatever. I've never seen The Mask, Pet Detective, or Living Color. But I love Jim Carrey. It's like, why? How did that happen?
Just a big fan of
Dumb and Dumber. That was the one I left out.
I was trying to think of what's the one where he's in a TV show?
Truman Show. Yeah.
I was thinking EdTV, the Woody Harrelson, or no, Matthew McConaughey. Or one of those guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. You saying let's not waste any more time made me think about a joke about wasting time, and then we wasted time. So let's now get into the comic.
Yes, let's not waste any more time.
So what's going on in World's End?
World's End is two people from our reality were driving across country at night in a snowstorm, and they entered a reality storm, which means they left our reality and went to a little nexus of realities, and they found an inn. Where they went in, and there's people from all kinds of realities who have been caught in the storm, and everybody's waiting in the inn, just basically waiting out the storm. And to pass time, they each take turns telling stories. And so each issue of the World's End arc is one of the people sitting around a table with our protagonists telling a story.
And everybody else seems like they've been here before. They're regulars to some extent.
Yeah, they're not like thrown off. They're like, oh yeah, reality storm. You got to hang out at the inn for a while, then we'll go back.
The main character is a little more thrown, though relatively nonplussed by everything that's going on.
Like our human protagonist?
Yeah, yeah. He recognizes that this is weird and strange, but he's not like screaming in horror at like the monsters and creatures that are running around.
He adjusts pretty fast.
Like the first thing he sees, I flipped through the first issue, is a centaur.
Right.
And he doesn't go, oh my God, a centaur.
Yeah. I think it is that, well, first of all, it's that very British kind of humor that Neil Gaiman has, which is like, well, that's quite odd. That sort of reserved reactions. But it's also just like, if everybody around you is acting normal, yeah, you might act normal.
I also just write it off as like the magic of the place.
Sure.
Like curbs that sort of freak out.
Yeah. There's also
it's dreamlike, right? In dreams, you sort of accept this stuff.
Right. There's also nobody totally gross looking. You know what I mean? There's no like blob with eyes that's, you know, waddling up to the table with a mug of beer. They're all like,
I don't know. Look at this first page, Will. Last panel. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. There's a lot of like little frog troll creatures that look like they maybe are in the claw machine of Toy Story.
Yeah.
Just looking around.
Holding little wine glasses.
That's pretty great.
That's pretty crazy. And like the main guy who's telling the story, his boss is like a undead zombie creature.
Yeah, they're pretty freaky.
I'm just saying I'd be nervous.
Not me.
Okay.
So that's the framing device. This particular issue, we learn the story of a guy named Petrifax, who is a like skeleton looking zombie who is an apprentice from a city called Necropolis, where everybody there is basically like an expert funeral parlor operator. A city where everybody is trained from the get-go to be good at burials. That's like the point of the whole city.
Yeah.
And Petrifax is one of them, and he's going to tell a story that takes place in Necropolis.
Yeah. It's a weird story from page one. Mm-hmm. A little easier to swallow. I read a lot of fantasy novels that sort of sometimes jump in on the deep end where it's just like dropping words and phrases and concepts as if they are known quantities.
Yeah. Like, let's get some sort of mithril armor, dear Aragorn, before we head off to Rohan kind of stuff.
Yeah. Because it goes in deep. Like the first page, like, from the window of my school, one can see the whole of Western Litharge. And it's like,
yeah.
Saying that, like, I know what that means.
Right. I would stare out at the necropolis on the hot summer afternoons and wonder about the world beyond the mountains. I would daydream of other places, other people, other worlds. He says at the necropolis. Maybe his city is not called Necropolis. Maybe his city is called Litharge. I don't know. He's from a city where everyone is in charge of learning how to do burials, and everyone looks like a skeleton, basically.
And he is taking a class.
Not a skeleton. They all look like sort of pale zombies. Yes, go ahead, Kevin. I'm sorry.
He's taking a class, and today's lesson is about the 5 approved methods of bodily disposal.
British authors love to write about, like, strict schoolmasters and sort of, like, it is just, I feel like every other Monty Python sketch was, like, a headmaster yelling at students. Every, like, Rowan Atkinson would be like a headmaster, you know what I mean? Hitchhiker's Guide. It's just like, all right, everyone up here. Today we're going to learn how to stab someone in the belly. That's right. Here's the knife. Here's the, pay attention now. Like, I feel like that is a trope of, like, British pop culture.
Well, it's here. And yeah, just and like I love it. Will's off the cuff example, he is learning sort of a very morbid lesson.
Yeah.
And so, like, the second page of the story, not the second page of the issue, he, like, lists in sort of detail the different ways you can dispose of bodies. Firstly, earth burial or interment. Variants are boxed, wrapped or naked, embalmed or otherwise, lying, seated or standing, graves, sepulture. How do you say that word?
I think that's right.
Vault or cairn. Carn.
Secondly, disposal through fire. Variants, clothed, boxed, pyre, vessel, or ship. Also, there are different procedures that can be adopted to dispose of the ashes.
Thirdly, mummification. Variants, salting, mineral baths, dehydration. There's a thing with pitch and bitumen and...
Yes. The fourth.
Fourthly?
Yeah, go ahead.
Fourthly, disposal through water. Variants include feeding to water animals or fish, disposal in sacred rivers or sea, boxing, bagging with rocks, dismemberment.
Then he can't remember the fifth. He's stammering. The teacher is glaring at him. He looks outside and sees a bird, and he remembers. Air burial, sir. Variants include dismemberment and otherwise, ingestion by raptors or scavengers, complete or partial disposal. And he's very satisfied, and the teacher is satisfied.
Yeah, there's moments during this, like, where he doesn't remember the fifth and the teacher's, like, grinning at him and not knowing the world yet. I'm like, oh, does he die if he gets this wrong? It seems like the sort of, like, a monster school of some sort. And at this point, it seems he's definitely taking a class in how to dispose of bodies, but I don't necessarily know it's the whole city of disposing of bodies. So it's very unnerving, the whole thing.
Properly begins when Petrifax is told by his teacher, Master Klaproth, who's also in the World's End with him, that he has to go witness a burial in some part of town as part of his apprenticeship, and it starts in an hour. And so he races across town to get there, and he's with a bunch of other residents of his town, and they are mid-burial.
Yeah, I mean, then the burial starts, they, like, cut this guy's neck, they slit open his stomach, they pull out his intestines and feed them to birds. It's gross.
Yep, and it's all being done very properly with, like, established protocols. It's got that Sandman or Neil Gaiman kind of just, like, fun with specifics and detail and grossness. You know what I mean? It's not just your garden variety, leave a body out to be fed on by birds. It's like 2 pages of cutting this body. But there's a lot of cutting bodies up in Sandman. We had one in Game of You with George's face getting cut off.
There's a guy with a meat grinder, like you'd see at a butcher shop, just grinding up parts of the body. Again, feeding them to, it's all getting fed to vultures and other scavenger birds.
And so at some point, Petrofax has the option of leaving, but he decides to stay for the end.
Yeah. They eat sandwiches, and Petrofax is like, oh, shouldn't we wash our hands? And he's told that would be disrespectful to the client. Anyway, his remnants are said to add savor to the food. That is the custom of the place from which the client hails.
And Petrofax doubts that. You're not pulling my leg like when I first apprenticed to Master Kalproth and the others sent me off to find a left-handed coffin.
But he eats it, and at some point he goes, it's true, this food does taste better. It shouldn't, but it does. This tastes really good. Why is that?
And so part of this, I know, it's very gross and funny. So part of this ritual is they've just buried, they call him the client. It's almost like everybody who dies is their client they have to serve.
Yeah.
And part of the ritual is, now that the burial's done, part of just their ritual as like burial people is to sit around a fire and tell stories.
Yeah.
So we're already a story within a story here.
Right.
And now we're going to go another level deep.
And to jump way ahead, I think the next issue reveals all this entire arc has been a story.
Yeah, that's right.
That he is telling at a bar.
That's right. The main protagonist is telling it in a bar in the future. So yes, that's right.
So we're,
but not
we're
not counting that level. Let's just count the levels that exist within this issue.
Yeah, that's
right. So there's World's End is the top level, the World's End Inn.
Yeah.
Now we're into Petrofax's story, second level. And now around the fire in Petrofax's story, we're going, I'm counting like Inception levels.
Yeah.
So now we're a third level, but there's sort of several.
That's the van going off the bridge. I don't remember the Inception levels. I know that's one of them.
Somebody tells a story about a hangman, a guy. Yeah, go ahead.
So this story, let's tell this. What's this story? Well, the hangman story.
This is a pretty short story, being told by one of the cut open the body people. He tells a story of a man who was supposed to be hung, but there was nobody equipped to run the hangman's gallows. And so he was allowed to be a hangman's gallows and hang everybody else. And then as soon as there was nobody else to be hung, he would be killed.
Well, I think before he dies, he needs to get hung. That's his death has to be by hanging.
His sentence has to happen at some point.
But so he lives his whole life just hanging everybody else, hoping to put it off as long as possible. And then he sort of tricks his way into not being hung.
He gets very sick at some point, and they're like, oh, they're going to hang you so you don't die by your illness. And he's got a family, and he just wants to die at home. And some friends help him weekends at Bernie's It by propping him up with a rope with a hangman's noose. And so that he looks healthy, and the city officials leave him be, and then he dies at home. So he cheated his sentence.
Yeah. A happy ending for that man who died.
Yep. And then Hermes tells the next story. What is this one?
That's right. And his story involves lots of little stories almost to begin with, right?
Yeah, he makes reference to lots of little things that have happened to him in his time.
Yeah.
But his main story has to do with destruction.
Yes. Who I didn't recognize immediately. It took me a bit to realize that was destruction, even though I just had read him couple episodes ago in our timeline.
In Brief Lives, yeah. So that he was like hanging out, and destruction came sitting by and talking to him. And destruction just hangs out with Hermes, one of the cut open the body people. And basically destruction says that this city that Hermes is in, the city of burial rites, is not the first one. There's been older ones that were not good at their job and got wasted away, because destruction isn't endless and he's been around since the beginning of the universe.
It seems like Litharge is the name of this place. But this place is a necropolis, so it's the Necropolis Litharge, because this character Hermes says that, to which Destruction says, this isn't the first necropolis, you know?
And he tells a story of the death of Despair.
Okay. I didn't know who it was that had died. I was trying to figure that out.
Yeah, despair. The despair that we know is the second despair. And so Destruction remembers that when he was a member of the Endless, they showed up at an older necropolis looking for the burial rites for their sister Despair. And the people there didn't know about it. And so Destiny declared them unfit and had the whole city destroyed.
Right. And that's when I realized this had been Destruction, because you get to this page where the Endless show up, but you see them from behind at first. So yeah. It's just you can't really make out who everybody is for sure, though Will knew right away. And they're like, our sister is dead. They said, where's the body? Where's the offering? And I was like, oh, wait, this is the Endless. I had forgotten. I think I didn't recognize Destruction because I wasn't even thinking about what comic book I was reading. And then I flipped back. I was like, oh yeah, this was Destruction telling the story. That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. And so that was how Necropolis Litharge got its name. Now we rise up out of this level back to level 2, the body cutting people around the fire. And now the headmaster of this ritual is going to tell his story. And this is the main story of this issue.
Is it?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I think the whole thing, I think the framing is the main, I think of that as the main story.
I guess you're right.
Just because this is only a few pages.
Somehow
it is the longest of the stories within the stories within the story, but.
That's true. Okay. There's definitely an argument for what you're saying, but whatever its importance is, we come to it.
Yes.
And so.
I mean, it's definitely what connects this to Sandman.
Right. Although I guess that last one with the Destruction attached to it. Oh, whatever. Right. Okay, so this guy, the master of the body cutting open ritual, sitting around the fire, tells a story of when he was a kid, and he had a teacher who was very strict, named Mistress Veltis, and who would yell at them, and he remembers when he was a kid being scolded by her for not doing his duties right. And then she tells him a story.
And she has like a withered hand. It looks almost like a ghost hand.
Yeah.
That's like faintly drawn.
Right.
And thinner. So she can't work with her right hand. She has to do everything with her left hand. And she's, why does she start telling this story?
There was a storm and the kids at Hogwarts, whatever the Hogwarts of Litharge is, couldn't sleep. And she, as the professor, yes. McGonagall, came in to soothe them by telling them stories. Right.
Harry Potter had been a different book if it was all about burial rites.
Just saying, those British authors, they love their school metaphor framing devices. So in comes Mistress Veltis. Okay, so how many levels in are we right now? We're 3? And then we're 3, right? World's End.
This is a story being told at World's End, and this is a story being told to the character who's telling a story, and then in his story,
he's being told
this
a story.
This woman is telling a story, yes.
So we're 3.
So we went 3 in for Destruction too, right?
Right, because Destruction told the story, yeah.
Yeah.
So we're 3 in. So this is Mistress Veltis' story of being young, and she also tells a couple of tales.
Yes.
But her main story is how she was, when she was a kid, learning her burial rites. Oh, she talks about World's End.
Right. Yes, I noticed that when I was reading that earlier. She mentions, she tells these stories really quickly. He refers to a bunch of stories that she has told. There was one about a mortician who outwitted a giant and inherited a kingdom thereby. That's one story. Another about a poor gravedigger who dug down to a magical land under the world and brought back a pale bride whose feet never quite touched the ground. That's a story. There's a story about a coach full of apprentices and a master swept away from Litharge by dark magics who took their refuge in a tavern where the price of haven was a tale, which is World's End, which is weird because is that what happened to... Is that the story of the characters that
are
telling this story?
It can't be.
Why not?
Because it would loop around in a weird way.
Yeah, and that would make it illogical to you?
I don't know.
That is a group of apprentices,
yes,
and their master.
Yeah, it's true.
I think it is them. I think time doesn't make sense in the World's End.
Okay, so she's telling a story of Claprox and Petrifax getting stuck in World's End, even though this is a story within the one told by Claprox and Prentice.
That's what I believe.
All right, I'm with it. So the other story that Mistress Veltas tells is when she was a little girl.
Will says that doesn't make sense, despite this being a story about the endless creatures that all start with D's.
Well, you know.
And they're visiting a world of burial rites.
I accept your mockery, but I do like my fantasy stories to have strong internal logic. And then he's playing it fast and loose here. But
I mean, it's a reality storm.
Yeah, I know. It's just like in a time travel story, though. You need some kind of boundaries or the whole thing just ends. All right. Anyway. Okay. So, Mistress Veltas, one of the stories she tells, three levels deep in this story of story of stories, is that she breaks some embalming fluid and is worried about getting yelled at and just runs through a bunch of tombs without minding where she's going. And she just ends up in a strange room with sort of like, it looks like there's a place awaiting bodies. Like there's like, there's robes being hung up. Six of them. And when she gets into this, yes.
And there's a big book, a tome, like on a podium.
Yeah, and we realize that this is the room with the items meant to bury one of the endless. This has got the equipment that you need if you have to bury one of the endless. And this is what Destruction and his family came looking for in his story, and they didn't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
But in this incarnation of a necropolis, the one called Litharge, they do know about it, and here it is. But Mistress Veltas doesn't, the young Mistress Veltas doesn't know about it, and here she is, and she hears a voice that says to her, which of them is dead? And she's confused and she's scared. No one's dead, not that I know of, just the usual people. I broke a flask of preserving fluid, I ran away. A voice in the darkness laughed. This is no place for you, little girl. Let me sleep until I am needed. And then the girl's scared and she goes, but I dare not leave. My master will have the skin off my back. And this is a kind of interesting thing. The strange voice, the voice that's in charge of the burial of the endless, takes pity on her, right?
Yeah, it's who is this person? It's like another, the gods to the gods in some way, maybe.
Yeah.
Very well, the flask is mended and filled, and your master has not noticed your absence. Now leave this place, and I will guide your feet to the world above.
And instead of just saying thank you and leaving, she commits one of those like weird sins of old stories where she doubts. How do I know that you're telling the truth?
Ah, well, there's a question. Had you had faith and not demanded proof, you would have been wiser. But seeing you need proof that I speak truly, look at your right hand.
And the girl Veltas looked at her hand, and she looked as it withered and twisted. There's your proof, said the voice. And when the girl wandered back, everything was as said. The flask was mended. Nobody was the wiser. And she was never able to find that room again.
Right. And then just before she died, she asked to be taken back to the catacombs for one last hunt.
So we're rising out of her story. And this right. is now just the master's story sitting around the fire.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And in her old age.
She goes in. We don't hear what happens to her in there. She's in there for, we waited there for a day and a night, Killaproth and I. And in the end, we heard a shrill scream and Mistress Veltas stumbled out into the daylight. We carried her back to our digs and sent the messages to the rest of the citizens of Litharge that they were less by one. We laid her out in the parlor and all of Litharge filed by to pay their respects. And if anyone else noticed that her hand was whole again, well, they said nothing.
That's a great one.
Yeah.
And so we're back around the fire, and our man, Petrifax, says he has no tales, no stories to tell, and just dreams of going places. And they're like, all right, well, that's fine. We got three stories. That's enough. And so they wrap it up, and they head back to the city. And that's the end of Petrifax's tale, and so we go back to World's End. Oh, no, something else.
Oh, right. Yes. The guy telling the story at World's End.
Petrifax. Starts,
yeah. It was 6 months later before I dared to ask him about the room below the catacombs and the book and the cerements. But I only learned more when I was raised from Prentice to Journeyman and swore on the Bagulaka that I would tell, hold your tongue!
And then
the master snaps at him.
Yeah, he's about to talk about the burial rites of the endless.
Yeah.
But Claproth scolds him. And the way he scolds him is kind of fun. There's like some little ritual of reminding him his honors. Petrofax, you have the key to the city? Yes, master. What is its virtue? To open and shut, to shut and to open. Where do you keep it? In an ivory box between my tongue and my teeth, and within my heart where all my secrets are kept. How long is the chain to the key? As long as from my tongue to my heart. There are strangers present. You will hush now. It's kind of fun to have a little back and forth that basically reminds you to shut the fuck up.
Some sort of like a oath he's taken a few times, it sounds like. And then the story wraps up with the main character of World's End guessing that maybe everyone at World's End is dead.
Yes, and the burial people go, young man, if you were dead, I think I would know it. I have some experience in these matters. And then he goes, well, does anyone have a better explanation? And then one of the people at the table goes, yes, I do. But that'll be told next issue, which we will not go over.
That's right. I think she might be the person running the World's
yes,
End.
Yes, yes. Then the next issue is the last issue that wraps everything up.
Hey, it's us again, your hosts, Kevin and Will Hines, and we want to hear from you.
That's right. You can email us at screwitspidey@gmail.com. You can tweet at us at screwitcomics. We also have an Instagram account where we post images from the comics that we talk about, and that's screwitcomics on Instagram.
That's three different ways to connect with us. Tell us your thoughts about the issues we're talking about, or the format of the show, or our life choices that have led us to this point. Reach out and tell us anything, honestly, and we might talk about it on a future episode of this podcast.
Thanks for listening to Screw It, We're Just Going to Talk About Comics from Campfire Media.
I love that issue. Kevin, thanks for going over it with me.
No problem.
I love this, the sheer number of stories in this. It reminds me of another issue we did, the Calliope issue, where an evil writer gets his brain flooded with stories and he's like babbling all the ideas out loud as he goes insane. And a number of those ideas sounded like good ideas for stories. Some of them didn't. Some of them sounded so vague or whatever. It didn't have to be good. The point was he was just being overwhelmed with ideas, but some of them did sound good.
Because even this one has a couple, three or four caption boxes that are like, well, that could be a whole story. Any of these mini stories could have filled out a whole issue. Once again, Will standing by, doubling down on his Neil Gaiman is good at writing claim.
Yeah. It is confusing. Like I enjoy the complexity.
This one's confusing to recap for certain. This might have been a hard to listen to episode.
Yeah. It's a little hard to read too. Like I love it. And I love complexity in these Sandman stories, but the characters are very clear and fun. And there's moments that are, and devices that are clear and fun, like the Library of the Endless. But sometimes the overall plot is so complicated, I can't remember. I have found that to be true when I'm rereading the issues on this visit.
Cool ideas in it. And if you don't catch the endless part, that doesn't matter. And if you don't know that this is a reality storm, that doesn't really matter. It's just stories that are being told.
It kind of reminds me of
each story in of themselves is pretty interesting.
It reminds me of certain movies I'd watch, like where it's like about somebody uncovering conspiracy theories in the government or something, like The Parallax View or 3 Days of the Condor or something. And like, there's always twists and turns where like a person you trusted turned out to be a spy or whatever. And then sometimes when you sit back and you try to like map out, you're like, wait a minute, does it even make sense? Like if this person was a spy, why'd they do this or something? But like while you're watching it, if it's good, you don't notice that. The ride is fun. It twists when it needs to twist. Not necessarily because of what that looks like from a bird's eye view of the tale. And Sandman is like that experience.
Yeah, a lot of noir detective stories are like that too. It's like, who can you trust? They try to keep you guessing till the end of the story. It's like, is the femme fatale good or evil? Is she going to betray the detective or is she not going to betray the detective?
Or both, weirdly. Like,
Often it is that. It's like, well, she'll go wherever she needs to survive.
When I read The Maltese Falcon after watching the movie, because I'm a smarty pants show off, the book is basically at the end of every chapter, somebody betrays. And it's just sort of like, well, who will betray this chapter? And like, and it almost seems like Dashiell Hammett, the author, made up his reasons after. It's like, well, you know what? This guy was doing this to, you know, it doesn't really matter. It's fun.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was The Big Sleep where I think the guys making the movie called up...
Raymond Chandler.
Marlowe's the character. Raymond Chandler, yes. And said, like, this ending doesn't make sense. Why did, like, they wanted him to explain
something? Something wasn't addressed. Like, this character mentioned this, and that never gets wrapped up or something.
Yeah, and he was like, oh, I don't know.
he couldn't explain it either.
And so the movie had to make some changes to make it make sense to them, yeah. Which is very funny.
Yeah. Okay, that's Saramis.
Have you seen Brick? Have you seen the movie Brick?
No, I've heard it's... I love Rian Johnson. I should see it. I've heard it's really good.
It's basically The Big Sleep. Teenagers, like with Juno talk.
That's fun.
Yeah, I think it's really fun.
I've enjoyed every Rian Johnson movie I've seen, so I should see that one.
Yeah, you should.
All right, I'll do it now.
All right, okay. So listen to Will for the next hour and a half. We're going to record this. We have some emails, Will.
I love it.
How would people email us?
You can email us at screwitspidey@gmail.com. That's our email address left over from our first season. We also have an Instagram account, screwitcomics, which I implore you to follow. We really should be doing this in some sort of visual medium, but we're not. We're doing it in an audio medium. But at our Instagram, you can at least see some captured images of the things we're talking about. And we have some other social media stuff too, but those are the two main ones. ScrewItSpidey@gmail.com and ScrewItComics on Instagram.
We've got 5 emails today, Will.
All right.
I'm going to read
10 of them.
I'm going to read them in not order received, but.
All right.
We got an email from Brian Pulverenti.
Good.
Who lives in New Jersey, just like me. Good for you, Brian. Dear Milksops.
I love that's just become first, solidly.
Yeah, that's just who we are now.
Yeah.
First and foremost, I absolutely love your podcast.
Oh, thank you.
Sincerely, it brightens up my day every time I see it in my feed. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Brian. Jeez Louise.
I know Will's answer to this, but I'm going to read this anyway. Have you guys read Tom King and Jorge Fornes's Rorschach number one?
I have not.
I have. I thought it was fantastic.
I like Tom King.
I thought it was fantastic. I know you've talked about him in passing, but what are your guys' thoughts on Tom King's work? I, for one, am a huge fan of everything he does. Best, Brian from New Jersey.
Now, Tom King's the guy who did that Vision series, and he did a Mr. Yes. Miracle series, right?
Yes.
Okay, I've read those.
Okay.
And I really enjoy him. He reminds me in a weird way of Matt Fraction, not quite like in his style, but just that he has a real distinct voice, which kind of like is more dominant than the characters or the story that's going on. Like the dialogue that happens and the things that it's kind of like an emo anxiety ridden take on stuff, which I think is really fun. But I think if I read a lot of Tom King in a row, I would need a little break to refresh.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
And where do you fall on Watchmen characters, new stories about Watchmen characters?
I mean, my instinct is don't do it. It's this perfect little watch that doesn't need to be tampered with. But on the other hand, I don't think it'll hurt anybody. I think like bad stories get forgotten. And so if you write a weak little story, it'll just be forgotten. And if you somehow write a good one, then good for you.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I guess I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth there. I'm going to say I think it's a fool's errand, but I guess if you kick it to the uprights, you kick it through the uprights.
All right. I've read, I think, almost everything Tom King has done. The first thing he did was Omega Men that I knew about, which is a cool little miniseries set in sort of the cosmic DC universe that I really enjoyed. The Vision that he did for Marvel is probably my favorite thing he did. I think that is just a perfect 12-issue series.
Yeah.
I think Mr. Miracle is pretty good. It's beautiful looking. It felt a little long for what it was, but I enjoyed it. He did a series called Sheriff of Babylon that was great, sort of a war story. A guy, I think it was set in Afghanistan about soldiers. And I thought that was incredible.
Hmm.
But I've recently I've cooled on Tom King. I still like him a lot, but he's doing an Adam Strange series right now that it looks great, but I just can't get into.
Okay.
It just feels like issue. And a little bit, this happened to me, I felt this in Mr. Miracle. But it just feels like issue after issue, I'm like, well, what's going on?
Yeah.
Just tell me.
Right.
And I feel like I'll get to issue 12 and I'll be like, oh, I guess I kind of know now.
Right.
And I'm like, you could have done this in 6 issues and I still would have, it would be just as good, if not better. I wouldn't have spent so much money on it and spent so much time on it. So it feels arbitrarily set to 12 issues to me to some extent. Adam Strange also bothers me because until it's revealed at the end, I guess I don't know, but I'm like, this doesn't feel like the Adam Strange that I would want it to be.
Okay.
It doesn't need to be, honest, obviously, but I don't love it. He also did a long run on Batman that I didn't love. It felt too violent.
Mm-hmm.
There were certain issues of this run that were incredibly good.
Mm.
And then there'd be arcs where I would just be like, ugh, I just don't care about it at all.
Mm.
And so I think that was such a long run that that really hurt my love of Tom King's stuff. I just read too much Tom King. And if I just had read what you had read, I'd probably still have a very strong feeling for him. That being said, the first issue of Rorschach was great.
Huh. Did it just come out or something?
It just came out recently, so it's only been one issue. It was really good. I'm not going to say much about it other than, like, Rorschach's not in it. Okay. It's about somebody who dressed up as Rorschach and committed a crime, and somebody's investigating that crime.
Okay.
It might, who knows where it will go from there, but yeah. it was good. Jorge Fornes is an amazing artist. Hopefully I'm saying his name close to right.
Hmm.
I didn't look it up beforehand. So it's beautiful. It's well written. It's very interesting. I was very down on any Watchmen stuff for a while.
It always seems like a mistake.
It's just like Watchmen was like DC's number one selling book even now.
Is that right?
Why are you trying to get more money out of this? Like, just let it work for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, Al Moore's never going to be happy, so you don't need to make him happy, but I'm also like, every movie, every TV show is based on something or a reboot, or it just feels like no one wants to come up with new ideas. It's all old things that have already been established.
Yeah. And yet Watchmen itself was this like burst of new ideas.
Right. Even though it was based on the Charlton characters, it was all new.
It was all original.
When you finally got to it. Mm-hmm. It was inspired by things, but it was all new. So that just, it just seems like a shame to like mine this thing for more ideas. But there's been so much Watchmen stuff from DC Comics and HBO that I'm just like, well, it's going to happen. So if you're going to do it, at least get good creators to do it. And that's what this is. That's a long answer to a simple question.
Thank you for telling us about it. Yeah. Need a bunch of stuff. Do you think you could do it? Or would you be hard to please? Like, would you reject issues when they came in? You're like, this is shit.
I mean, it would be so tough, right? Because you'd have to be worried about making money.
Yeah.
I think I'd be good at quality control. And I think I would be pretty good at being like, well, this isn't for me, but I think
it works or whatever.
Because there's lots of stuff that I'm not into, but I get that there's six. I get why people like it. I just don't read it myself. I think it would be a tough to say, like if I ran Marvel Comics being like, no big crossover this summer, so that they really like the next one. Where like everyone else is being like, yeah, but it will make us a lot of money.
Right.
I'm like, oh yeah, that is important. Making of Seinfeld.
Oh, I didn't know there was one.
It's just, I don't know when this was filmed, probably on one of the DVD releases. It's like the start of Seinfeld or something. I think this was filmed before the show was over, but I can't be certain. It covers like the first three seasons of the show. And it's such, the show was not a hit. Nothing about that show said it should have been made.
Right.
It was really funny to watch this. But I watch it, I'm like, it's crazy that like this one guy basically just kept saying like, I think we should make this show.
Brandon Tartikoff.
I've liked it, but he didn't put it on the schedule. And this guy was like, I have money for like two hours of specials. Let's make four episodes of Seinfeld instead with that money.
Oh, interesting.
And then they were offered, whoever was producing Seinfeld was offered, we'll either burn this off over the summer after Cheers or like in the fall, or we'll put it in the fall, like when all our new shows launch, but it'll be a much worse slot. And he's like, put it after Cheers. I'd rather if people see it than just put it somewhere else.
Right.
And then like it got picked up for 13 more episodes and it was like put on Wednesdays or some other time slot at first before it got moved behind or before Cheers. I forget where it ended up going initially. Maybe after Cheers. And that's where it's finally started picking up steam. But even that, like they were like, don't make the Chinese food restaurant episode, they told them.
Rick Ludwin, is that the guy's name?
Yes, I think that's it. Okay. It was Rick something.
Okay.
At some point, like they turned in the script for the Chinese food restaurant for the second season, which is 22 minutes of waiting for a table.
Right.
And like, you can't make this episode. Your show is barely hanging on. You're going to kill whatever goodwill you have. And they're like, oh, we really like it. And I'm like, okay, you can make it if you want. We're telling you it's a bad idea. So they made the episode, and NBC wouldn't air it till like the second to last episode of the season. And then it's like one of the most famous episodes of the show.
Yeah.
Anyway, things like that. I'm just like, that's crazy to me to be like, this will work. Give it 3 years.
Yeah.
We need that. ER was huge right away. We need another ER.
Yeah.
We don't need Seinfeld.
BJ and the Bear knocked people's socks off. Give us another BJ and the Bear.
I think that stuff would be really tough.
Yeah. I think I'd be perfect at it.
Wow, I didn't expect that answer. Mm-hmm. Show?
It looks like really well informed and done with a lot of love, and mm-hmm. the guy actually met Steve Ditko and didn't include it, which I thought was honorable. I mean, he mentioned, you know, he made good with whatever Steve Ditko requested, which was don't include me or anything I say.
Yeah.
The interview
I also haven't seen it.
The interview he has with Stan Lee is really interesting.
I also haven't seen it, and that's crazy because I love Steve Ditko. Yeah. And there's no good answer for why I haven't seen it, because I just talked about watching a half hour special on a show that really I didn't need to see. So I could watch this easily, but I haven't. I have not watched it yet. I guess Neil Gaiman's in it is what he's saying.
Yes, that's right. I remember that.
So he sent us a link that's queued up to where Neil Gaiman shows up, Will.
Okay. I might have been territorial. Like, we were doing our whole thing on Ditko. I was like, I don't want to watch somebody else's thing on Ditko. But that's dumb because I've heard it seems really good.
The first thing I heard about was like him going to the door and talking to him, right?
Yeah.
Even though like, and that felt so invasive to me.
But he doesn't include that footage then.
Yeah. But apparently the special like helps a lot of people figure out where he lived, which I guess you can figure out by looking it up anyway.
Yeah, Ditko didn't hide, you know, like I don't begrudge that.
It feels weird to air on TV, like here's somebody's phone number or apartment building.
He listed his number in the phone. I think Ditko was a weirdo who liked that little game of, I've no way to verify that, but maybe we'll get Jerry Duggan on here someday and he can talk about the letters he exchanged with Steve Ditko, which you can see on Jerry Duggan's Twitter.
Get him on.
Jerry Duggan, the Deadpool writer, had exchanged letters with Steve Ditko, and they're really interesting.
Currently writing The Marauders for the X-Books at Marvel.
Nice,
good series. Justin Bridge emails us. He talks a lot about New Mutants. He yells at me for forgetting Karma's name a few episodes ago.
Right. I'm glad you're getting yelled
at. He's right. It took me too long to remember that name.
I mean, she was only in for one issue, right? And then came back for it later.
He says, technically Karma is the first New Mutant. She came from a Fantastic Four story, no less. They kind of never knew what to do with her. She's crazy powerful, but also crazy vulnerable. But then he talks about Sandman. I'm going to cut to that part. Great Sandman stuff. I love the Destruction arc. It is probably not surprising that by meeting Destruction, Sandman hastens his own. Does Destruction actually mention this? Question mark. As Kevin has pointed out, and this is actually something Will has pointed out, but he gives me credit, which is cool. The endless personalities tend to be the opposite of what they represent. Destruction actually has a great deal of affection for his family, but by staying away, they stay alive. By seeking Destruction out, Sandman is essentially committing suicide, as we see in the last arc. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
And this, of course, has been telegraphed almost from the beginning, right? Once Sandman escapes his prison, his first stop is to meet with his sister Death. Most of the rest of the run is him righting his previous wrongs or shoring up the dreaming before he goes.
Yep.
No wonder he's emo. He's living the emo dream.
And that's true.
Any comments on any of that stuff?
I hadn't noticed that he began right away preparing for his death, but that is something that is, I could see that. Like, I have no idea if that was actually Neil Gaiman's intention, but that's, you could easily look at it like that. I mean.
Sure. I mean, yeah, you could, that might be why he's smiling at the end of that death issue. He's like, oh, and now I know what's going on. I'm dying.
I mean, I think what is on purpose is he was supposed to have been cold and distant, and now he's been humbled and is becoming warmer and more amenable to, like, fixing old wrongs. I think that's said very clearly. But I guess one could see that's something you do when you're winding down, or you know on some level you're winding things up.
That reminds me, in this issue we just read, Destruction sings a song that he wrote himself, right? Because you say he's always creating stuff.
Yep, he's very creative, yeah.
Stuart Watson emails us.
Yeah.
Will always entreats new readers of Sandman to write in, so I thought I'd oblige.
Ooh. I hated it.
I'm a big comics fan who has written before regarding Hulk and casting the JLA as 70s TV detectives. And have read most of the canon of great comics. As a youth, I always found them too soporific, ironically. You covering them has forced me to stay up long enough to finish an arc or two. I'm glad to have read the truly great moments, but around halfway through your Sandman coverage, I'm admittingly listening along but no longer reading the issues as they aren't quite grabbing me.
Ah, fascinating. Maybe we picked the wrong
Sandman
ones.
Sandman is more geared to panty waist and milksops when I am more of a Poindexter. Still love the coverage, though. My question is, which comics of the accepted great comics canon have you either never read or tried to read and can't get into?
That's interesting. I mean, I've never been a big Avengers reader or Cap America. I've never really been able to get into that wing of Marvel, for example. Mm-hmm. If we're talking like old school, like classic comic stuff, The Spirit is something that always looked beautiful to my eyes, but I never loved reading, even though any one panel of The Spirit was always beautiful, except for the blatant racist caricatures that are all sure, over yeah. that comic. But like, just in terms of like, you know, inks and like rainy New York City and stuff, that Doom Patrol, I haven't read a lot of Grant Morrison stuff. I haven't been able to get into, and he's pretty, I've liked a lot of Grant Morrison. I don't know. Kevin?
I've liked the Spirit of stuff I've read, but I think I've only read like the best of the Spirit type of stuff. That's just like great.
Yeah.
I think we both didn't like Preacher. That's a great comic that everyone loves. Yeah. That it, like at least people of a certain age.
I met it at the wrong time in my life, I think.
Made a lot of people love comic books again.
Yeah, which is great.
And I'm the only guy alive who doesn't really like Ultimate Spider-Man. When I read that, I sort of just like did it because I felt like I needed to. And it wasn't bad, but I didn't love it, and I sort of just worked my way through it all. And people love that series.
Yeah.
But as far as like classic comics, I've never read the Kirby Thor. I've never really tried.
I guess I haven't either. Well, a little bit, maybe like 10 issues.
I read one volume of Avengers Essentials, the Kirby era, and it was fine. I don't know if that's considered classic or just first.
Yeah.
I haven't read Jim Steranko S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff.
Okay.
It's really great looking, but I never was excited to read the next issue. It was like, well, I should do this. This is something I should have read. Yeah. It's kind of what I told myself. Because he was like one of those artists who kind of came in, because he came in and Stan Lee was still around and Stan Lee like let him be himself.
He didn't have to copy Kirby.
He wasn't doing Kirby. He was doing Steranko. I mean, Steranko is an insane person in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But his art was great.
Did he sex montage where it was like a couple's having sex and he drew all these like innuendos, like a gun going into a holster and stuff like that?
Maybe. I don't know about that. That sounds maybe like something he would do.
Yeah.
His S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff was like where S.H.I.E.L.D. went crazy, spy, James Bondy. Like it was already sort of doing that a little bit, but he dialed it up to like 20.
Yeah.
And I think it might be, he might have like a 6-page spread where it's like a huge battle sequence that goes across like 3 spreads or something.
Yeah.
It's something like that. He's got some crazy things going on. It's bonkers and detailed and... It feels very modern despite being a pretty old comic.
I found the page I'm talking about. I'll send you. It's on Pinterest. I can't look at it without like logging into like 6 things.
We've got one more email. I would say the most important email that we got.
Okay.
This is from Patch.
Uh-oh. Patch.
Yes. And Patch.
The tipster.
Not the character from Spider-Man.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, maybe we got a bad guy we got to go catch.
No. This is Patch. They write in about our handling of the trans character from...
Yes.
From Brief Lives? Game of You.
Game of You, yeah.
Game of You. I'm a big fan. I've been with you from the beginning, but this is the first time it seemed like I should write in. I wanted to talk about your latest episode, Sandman issue 34. You asked if anyone with a trans perspective could write in, so here I am. I don't want to sound accusatory, but to be honest, I had some concerns about the treatment of Wanda on your show, mm-hmm. and Wanda is the trans character from that storyline.
Mm-hmm.
That's me. Thing is, trans people are who they say they are. That's all there is to it. A fairly recent study discovered that brain structures in trans people match our identities, not our bodies. So we really truly are who we say we are. You complimented the handling in this issue, but to be honest, I pretty strongly disagree. Wanda's entire story is that people don't respect her or her identity. The only people who actually agree that she is who she says she is are Barbie and Death. Even you two repeatedly referred to her by her dead name and with the incorrect pronouns, even saying multiple times Wanda is a man. Her family, the people around her, even magic itself denies her identity in the issue, and it hurts. Imagine, if you will, that everyone around you insisted that you aren't who you say you are. You keep telling us that you're Will and Kevin, but everyone in the world insists that you aren't. And not only are you liars, but you're literally evil for insisting on telling the truth about who you are.
Right.
That's what Wanda's story is, and as a punishment for not being a woman, she dies. She's left behind because Moon and Thessaly won't accept her and dies as a consequence. Whereupon she's further disrespected by the mortician and her family. These are things I and people like me have to deal with every day. People tell me I'm wrong because I'm too tall or because my voice is too deep or because I like comics, which they say girls don't. None of that matters. We are who we say we are just as much as anyone else. I don't believe Gaiman would write like this today. Just last week, he co-signed a letter affirming the identities of transgender and non-binary people. This is all through a modern lens, of course. Weirdly, Wanda's experiences with transphobia and its consequences was the first time I encountered a trans person in media, and identifying so strongly with a woman who was serious about being who she was really got me thinking, even if it didn't crack my egg, so to speak. Anyway, that's probably a bit much, but I still wanted to send it. I guess I should apologize. You never asked for a full-on essay. Thanks, and keep swinging. Patch. And I wrote Patch back after this, Will, mostly because I wanted to thank them for emailing. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to clarify that I think, when I said, I think you were the same way, the handling was good. I don't think we meant this was a positive story for Wanda, because there's no...
Yeah.
Question it's not, but just that, like, the anguish and troubles and pains that she feels from her family and everyone around her and being left behind felt didn't feel glossed over.
Yeah,
like the pain and agony and of that was very real. Obviously the times that we use the dead name, her dead name, or the wrong pronouns, or saying Wanda's a man, that stuff we should have said it differently. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. I tried to be good about that. I probably slipped a few times. And I know you had just read the issue where the family.
Right. The funeral sequences.
Yeah. So we slipped a bunch there. We shouldn't have. We should have been way better about that. But I definitely think, especially for the era, that it was handling the pain of it well. And then I also said to Patch that I think. I don't know how Neil Gaiman would handle this story now, obviously. Maybe we'll find out. When it gets adapted, if it gets adapted into the live action series working on. But I think there is an interesting story about a fantasy world that has rules that rub up against gender identity.
Yeah.
I don't think this story was its main point, though. Yeah. So I don't think it ever really handled it. And that, I think, could be a criticism of it for sure, being like, why are you bringing this up if you're not going to really dig into it?
Mm.
And then Pat wrote back, and I'm not going to get into that. Right now, I'll write Patch back afterwards. But Patch was definitely not mad at us and just sort of being like, hey, you asked for my opinion. Here it is.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful for them sending it to us.
Yeah. Thanks for writing in. It's, I don't have a perspective from personal experience to know what it would feel like. So... It's illuminating and interesting to hear somebody. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it must be very hard to read a story, even if it's well told. I mean, a story about a trans person dying could, and I think Patch even says that sort of as a trope, right? Of, oh no, in the response refers to as a trope of killing your gays. Mm-hmm. And like, same thing as like killing women in stories to motivate men, killing trans people to motivate straight people could be seen as the same way. And there is something awful about that. That's often the storylines. And it must be weird because like there's so little representation that if there's a trans character and it dies in a horrible way, you're like, oh, this is awful. But like if I'm watching a story and a white man dies, I'm like, oh, who cares? But there's also like 30 more of them in that
same
story.
Right. Right. You don't think of it as the white character.
Yeah. I'm not, it doesn't affect me at all. I'm not like, oh, I can't believe they're doing that to this man.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's something definitely I don't think about. I have the luxury of it not bubbling up when I'm watching something. And it's hard to get yourself in that mindset of being like, oh yeah, this maybe is handled well in a horrible fashion, but doesn't need to be told that way.
Yeah. Thank you very much for writing in. I feel like I got to say my piece in our hour long examination of the episode. So I won't keep going. I'm going to say something. I would be still curious to know from anybody. I mean, don't feel like anybody has to write in from Patch or anyone. Like, does that mean that you, to the point where you dislike Sandman stories? Or is it more like a blind spot or something? This is hard for me to separate. When I was reading Sandman originally, it was like such an eye-opening experience in so many ways. And it was because it tackled so many difficult topics so with such comfort and confidence that it like made these things approachable in a way. I felt the same way about Love and Rockets comics, which are way more likely to be like problematic, I think, but or more outrageous, I guess, is what I should say. Love and Rockets comics could be way more cartoony. So I wonder if there's just risks. There's just like, if it's just like impossible to get it quote unquote right. And that's just the collateral damage of like being bold. I don't know.
It seems like Patch like loves the Sandman comics and even said that this was the first trans character they'd seen, but either in viewing back on it or just the idea that this is a well-handled story rub them the wrong way sense that like, I think you could love Sandman and be like, well, I don't like this arc. Like a stupid version of that for me is like, you recommended a podcast to me about children being taken. And I listened to the first episode. I was like, I don't think I can listen to this. It was just so hard to listen to. And I was like, it was a really well done. I mean, it affected me tremendously. So it was very well done. But I was like, I'm not in a place to listen to this.
Right.
I need to go find my son and hug him. He's next to me, probably. I'm not listening to a podcast about children being taken with him in the room. But, you know, like, so that stuff, sometimes it's just like, this is good, but I can't.
Yeah.
I can't do it. Because of my circumstances. And so, that doesn't necessarily mean the people making it. I'd be like, oh, those people make bad podcasts.
Yeah.
But I would be like, they're not. That's not for me. That season.
Well, thank you for writing in. That was interesting.
Yeah, thanks taking the time and speaking to that. We make those requests. We don't always get people to write in when we ask for those viewpoints. So it's really great to hear. And on that heavy note, Will...
We're good. Done. All right. So we'll be here next episode with the Kindly
issue
Ones,
69.
Issue 69. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is the last chapter of the Kindly Ones.
And then we'll do one more in the wake. And that's probably where we'll end our season.
That's probably it. Yeah.
All right.
So, Kevin, good job podcasting. And audience, we'll see you guys next episode.
Yeah. Unless this is just a podcast within a podcast within a story at World's End.
About two guys who podcast?
Yeah. I don't know. You'll find out when this ends, if this continues.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Screw it. We're just gonna talk about comics.
Hi, I'm Michelle Varey.
And I'm Kimberly Truong, and we are the host of Crush Fictionally, a podcast all about your favorite fictional characters from movies, TV shows, and more.
Each episode, we pick a theme, curate a list of characters that we love, why we love them, and some fun facts about the people who created them.
So if you've ever felt a true connection with a fictional character,
tune in to Crush Fictionally on Campfire Media
or wherever you find your podcast.
Campfire.